What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
This is the new Weight Watchers. It works for members like JoJo, who's learning simple, healthy habits, Sharia, who's making progress with meds, and Kim, who still gets to eat what she loves. For over 60 years, we've helped millions of members find what works for them. Now it's your turn. Watch your life open up. Watch your story shift. Watch what you're capable of. Watch it work. Get started today at WeightWatchers.com.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to The Katie Helper Show, and I'm your host, Katie Helper. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, and as always, remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow, where for just $1 a month, you can help make the show happen. And for $5 a month, you'll qualify for great bonus content, including alternative podcast feed and rarely seen clips that aired on our live shows. You're listening to The Katie Helper Show, and I'm your host, Katie Helper. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, and as always, remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow, where for just $1 a month, you can help make the show happen. And for $5 a month, you'll qualify for great bonus content, including alternative podcast feed and rarely seen clips that aired on our live shows.
Hello and welcome to The Katie Helper Show. We are so thrilled to be here with you. We have two amazing guests we are bringing back onto the show, and they are timeless wonders. So we are so excited. First, we'll be speaking to Cornel West, who needs no introduction, and then we'll be speaking to Ukrainian-American journalist Lev Galinkin. Now, before we start, please give the show a thumbs up. And if you can, please become Patreon supporters at patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow, and you get our full extended interviews and early access. And it's a great way to support the show. If you can afford $5 a month, you get the extra access, extra content. If you can only afford $1 a month, just know that literally we could not do the show without you. So those $12 a year from people really make the show happen. We are about to bring onto the show our first guest, who is the Dietrich Bonhoeffer Chair at Union Theological Seminary. He's a best-selling author. He's a philosopher. And he recently ran as an independent for president, none other than Cornel West. Welcome, Dr. West.
Yes, sister, you know it's always a blessing for me to spend some time to revel in your humanity and your commitment and your courage.
Putting a smile on
Sister Nora, your beloved mother's face.
Yes, that's true. Dr. West and Dr. Eisenberg, Nora, she's a PhD, as are you. She and you met at a great Julian Assange benefit that we did that Roger Waters was at, Randy Credico was at, and Cornel, of course, brought down the house. And
you were marvelous. You were marvelous that night. Your comedy,
you.
Your artistry.
Thank you. So, well, one, that's a good piece of news that obviously since we've last spoken, Julian Assange has been freed. One of the few good things that Biden did when it comes to freedom of speech. And I want to start off by asking you, what do you think happened during the elections? If you were surprised, you called it a battle between multicultural militarism and raw fascism. So what is multicultural militarism and why wasn't it able to defeat raw fascism?
Well, one is, I think that when you're dealing with a dying empire, And by that, what I mean is the spiritual decay and the political corruption becomes so thick that the only responses to the 62% of Americans who live in paycheck to paycheck and the 1% of the population having over 40-some percent of the wealth and the unbelievable levels of escalating misery and suffering in the country. And the only response you can have is the raw fascism of a Trump and the militarism led by a Black sister, a Asian sister, a multicultural sister who talks about lethal militarism in the way in which the neoconservatives did in the 1980s and 90s, which is tied to some of the most brutal imperial policies. And of course, one thing that I love about your show is that you remind us over and over again, we got a real genocide going on every day. This is a level of barbarity and bestiality and brutality we don't have a language for, but you have an empire in denial. And the corporate duopoly, the unbelievably corporate driven, greed laden, money-centered, political corrupt system, politically corrupt system, can only provide these two dominant responses. Now, some of us tried to provide some alternatives, and we did the best we could, you know, 17 months and 1,000 interviews and over 350 or so speeches and magnificent volunteers and Kiana Dent, who was my visionary campaign manager, and Brother Alex and Brother Mike and Brother Edwin, and of course, my beloved wife, Anahita, who did a magnificent job. And I can go on and on, and those folks, Stanley Talbert and Bashir and others who put in so much time to try to keep what we were doing alive. You know, the largest write-in campaign in the history of the country, 62 ballots. Assess the states when people told we only have about four or five. It was a tremendous effort. It was a beautiful thing. I met some of the most magnificent people I've ever met in my life, but I could see from the inside with real skin in the political game just how corrupt things were, to my dear sister, and how corrupt things really are. I mean, Democrats spent over $20 million keeping me off the ballot. I mean, it's like, please. Can you imagine? Is that the kind of priorities you have? Well, that was the best they could do. And that's what I'm calling multicultural militarism. And it's a way of trying to hide and conceal the levels of mendacity and criminality that so much of U.S. foreign policy actually is.
I call that woke washing when they do that.
Ooh,
woke washing imperialism.
Isn't that? I never heard that before.
Yeah, I coined it. Yeah, but I think you coined multicultural militarism, right?
Well, I think I may have been the first, but I'm not sure. But most importantly, I'm just trying to make sure that it's true, because as you know, not just our campaign, but our movements together is always about truth and justice and love, and those are the things that have tremendous problem gaining traction on the barren soil of the dying U.S. empire at the moment. But we got to keep fighting, keep telling the truth, keep seeking justice, and keep trying to enact and embody as much love as we can before the worms get our bodies.
Wow, yeah. Well, what surprised you most? What level of corruption? Because you are you're not cynical. You're the opposite of cynical, but you're definitely not naive. So what kind of corruption existed that you discovered that you didn't know about before?
With the level of aggression of the Democratic Party vis-a-vis democratic choices for citizens. I mean, here you got folk talking about they're going to redeem the soul of the nation. That was the slogan of Martin Luther King Jr. and Ella Baker and James Lawson and Diane Nash in 1957 when they founded Southern Christian Leadership Conference. You know, your mother was very much part of that Black Freedom Movement. I think it was with SNCC probably more than FCLC, but still.
Right.
Part of that Black Freedom Movement that your beloved mother was crucial part of and remains.
SNCC and CORE, both, I think,
Yes, absolutely. But the very fact that, you know, that became the motto of Biden. That became the motto of the Democratic Party. Then they talked about defending democracy and the anti-democratic practices internally and externally that they manifest showed the thickness of the hypocrisy and the ways in which the lies and crimes that have been so normalized and naturalized in the American governmental processes, that to see that up close was something I'd read about. It's something I'd been a part of in terms of hitting the streets and going to jail as an activist. But when you're actually running for office, it is a very different kind of experience.
What kind of things did the Democrats do? What was this different experience? How did they try to silence you?
Cancellations. I mean, I had massive cancellations of lectures. As you know, we went to court, went all the way to Supreme Court. Even I think Alito actually had to make a decision in terms of whether I got on the ballot in Pennsylvania. We went to the Supreme Court in North Carolina, went to court in Arizona. We lost in Arizona. We lost and then won in North Carolina. We lost in Michigan and then won in Michigan. We lost in Pennsylvania over and over again. And of course, the monies. I mean, my God. My whole campaign raised a little over $1 million. Democratic Party raised $1.5 billion in just a matter of 2 months. I mean, it's unbelievable. We ran out of cash. We never ran out of gas.
Right.
Oh, we got a spirit that the ruling class can never crush. They may dampen the fire, but they can never crush the candle flickering. And that's what our campaign was about. And that's what our movements have to be about. You know, we've got to be about of being able to do all we can to hold up a bloodstained banner of truth, justice, and love in a moment that is so grim, that is so dim. It's difficult to live in the last decades of an empire. We'll take the American empire probably another half century or so to completely undergo the fundamental implosion and transformation, but it's clear that the dying process is very much in place.
Well, you are an incredibly learned public intellectual also, and I consider you in the tradition of Gramsci. But as someone who studied empire and has such a vast encyclopedic breadth of knowledge, what makes you think that this is going to happen, that this shift in empire is going to happen? And what kind of, is it going to be a collapse, a death?
Yeah, it's hard to say. Is it a bang? Is it a whimper? It's very hard to say how empires themselves undergo their own forms of decay and deterioration and death. The United States is the 68th empire in the history of the species. It's been roughly 70. This is from the World Atlas. This is from the Al Ferguson's book and other scholars who have made this point over and over again, so I'm not the first to put this forward. But what is distinctive about the American empire is, one, its claims to innocence, is, two, its obsession with dreams. There's been no other empire in the history of the world to move from perceived innocence to corruption without a mediating stage of maturity, because the United States began with a big lie. It said that somehow it was born modern, born capitalist, born bourgeois, no talk about the genocide of indigenous peoples, no talk about slavery, denying class struggle, denying patriarchy in that way. Every empire we know have been shot through with forms of barbarism. Don't get me wrong. The whole species, we human species, we're wretched in that sense. We don't know a moment that has been structures of domination. There has been forms of organized hatred and weaponized weaponized hatred and routinized indifference. But the United States has this city on the hill mentality, so that when James Baldwin says the innocence itself is the crime. If you view yourself as innocent, why you're committing violence? And your major myth is the frontier, which is a line between the innocent civilized and the guilty savages, our precious indigenous brothers and sisters, and you get more regeneration through violence, then that's the worst of the country, and that leads directly to Trump. That leads directly to the worst in the nation. Now, the best in the nation is Martin King, Edward Said, Rabbi Heschel, Dorothy Day, Stephen Sondheim, Louis Armstrong, John Coltrane, Harriet Tubman. I can go on and on. Noam Chomsky, Chris Hedges. I can go on and on with the best of the nation. And what we were trying to do, of course, in the campaign was just to reintroduce America to the best of itself. And we did win many hearts and minds and souls. It was just, it was hard to gain access. The corporate media itself shot through with its own forms of corruption and accommodation to the unjust status quo made it very, very difficult for them to focus in that regard. I don't think I had one speech that the American public even heard. I mean, they heard more Cardi B, God bless her soul, than they heard of me in 17 months. Why? Because it's just so difficult to gain access to exposure and visibility. I was blessed to be on one number of wonderful shows, including your own, and some of the corporate media had an openness to interviews with me, but it was no sustained focus on the issues of poverty and mass incarceration and big money in politics and the ecological catastrophe and the escalating nuclear catastrophes with three sites of wars, be it with Russia or with China or in the Middle East and so on. No serious engagement with those issues. And as you know, Sister Katie, I mean, I'm a crack vessel that comes out of the Black Freedom Movement. You see, so I look at the world through the lens of those Frantz Fanon called the Wretched of the Earth, and begins on the chocolate side with me. And so I always look at the 40% of Black children who live in poverty. I'm concerned about mass incarceration, no serious discussion of it whatsoever. I'm concerned about the forms of spiritual decay that is shot through the hearts and minds and souls of Black people, as well as fellow citizens, as well as fellow human beings. And you can see the ways in which, when you live in a society in which everybody's for sale, and commodification is ubiquitous, and it's all about, you know, life is gold rush, worshiping the golden calf and transforming the golden rule into he or she who has the gold will rule, then you're going to get Black folk themselves seduced by corruption, seduced by bigotry, seduced by greed. Because these are human beings. We are human beings like everybody else. And the challenge is to try to be that cloud of witnesses to hold up that bloodstained banner. It was the abolitionists in the 19th century that everybody laughed at. It was the freedom fighters in the 1960s. Everybody laughed. You either laughed at him or they shot him down, assassinated him, incarcerated him. That's why Mumia Abu-Jamal is still in jail. Right. Brother H. Raff Brown, Brother Amani Min, Abdullah Al-Hamid is still in jail. Leonard Peltier is still in jail. I mean, these are folk who were very much a part of efforts to try to bring light on the forms of barbarism that was shot through the American Empire in the 1960s. And it's gotten so much worse now in terms of the corruption. Now, the irony is that we made some progress in terms of inclusion. I don't want to deny that at all. We've made progress as a result of social movements. But what has happened, of course, is that the imperial hierarchy and the class hierarchy has just invited all these different peoples of color and gender and sexual orientation to come in and be included without getting at the structures of the empire, the structures of the predatory capitalist mode of production, or the structures in terms of the ways in which professional classes, so tied to careerism and opportunism, simply make room for the newcomers without fundamentally transforming the structures as the newcomers are on their way in. And so you get these Black faces in high places and women faces in high places, gay and lesbian faces. Now, our precious trans, you know, I do want to stop and say a word about this because I'm deeply concerned about the way in which they have been so viciously demonized and viciously vilified. And so when they're human beings like anybody else, so they can be... They can make choices of right and wrong. But anytime you have a group that's being viciously vilified like that, and we've seen it in the history of the species, with Jews for 2,500 years, terrorized, traumatized. But when they get in positions of power, they can be human like everybody else because they are human. And they have the capacity to terrorize and traumatize too. And if we can't be flexible enough, be concerned about our Jewish brothers and sisters when they're being terrorized and traumatized, but also concerned about our Palestinian brothers and sisters when they're being terrorized and traumatized by Israelis, then something's wrong with our humanity.
Right.
Something's wrong with our solidarity, you see.
And something that you are very nuanced about is the way that class and racism intersect. And a lot of people... You, of course, don't dismiss the role of racism. I mean, far from it. but you also don't dismiss the role of class. And I think there's a tendency, a lot of people like to say that the only reason Trump wins is because of sexism and racism. That's a bit challenged, I would say. Not that people can't internalize white supremacy or sexism, but what do you think happened? Why? How does someone like Trump seduce people? And is it all just racism and misogyny or sexism? Or what else do you think is there?
Mm-hmm. That's a wonderful question, though. And I think it's very important that we situate ourselves intellectually in traditions that understand the relation of empire and class and race and gender and even region and sexual orientation. I think of somebody like the great Gerald Horn. I think he's one of the towering figures of our day. And he always looks at the world through the lens of the ways in which white supremacy and male supremacy have been shot through predatory capitalist systems of production, but always grounded in empire building or resistance to empire. And therefore, and one of the reasons why I spend as much time with the younger generation, you know, with Brother Coates, I have great respect for Brother Coates, you know, in terms of him raising his voice and so forth, especially now on the Palestinian issue. That's a beautiful thing in so many ways. But when you talk about race or when you talk about white supremacist practices and ideologies, not connected or grounded in imperial and predatory capitalist practices, you end up fetishizing racism and you make it as if it has magical powers as opposed to something that can be wrestled with in light of the role and function it plays in a capitalist world and in an imperial world in which the end and aim is short-term gain, which is financial. The end and aim is status, too. The end and aim is forms of power that will degrade and demean people. So you got exploitation, you got domination, and you got degradation. That's just Malcolm X's language. Not just, that's Malcolm's language. And that's a tradition that needs to be accented if we're going to ever have the kind of truth-telling and the forms of solidarity required to change it. Because you see, if you view racism as just some isolated thing that has magical powers, you're going to end up an Afro-pessimist that thinks mm-hmm. that somehow this is an ontological condition. This is primordial. It will never, ever, ever, ever change. So all we can do is moan and be bystanders and be spectators. No, we got to be participants. We got to be interveners. And we have to understand history is something, no matter how low and whatever nadir history reaches, it can still be changed and transformed. And the people say, was that naive? No, that's naive. I'm not an optimist at all. You and I have talked about the blues on many occasions on your show and others. I'm a blues man. I come from a blues people. And the blues ain't got nothing to do with optimism whatsoever, but it is an enactment of hope. And hope is a verb as well as a virtue. In motion, to stay in movement.
That's interesting. You just made me think of something, and I'm literally just thinking of it. And the parallels, I don't want to go too far in it, but there is something to the way that Zionism requires anti-Semitism to function. And there's not a real parallel with, well, maybe there is with Afro-pessimism and how they're in certain contexts, racism is almost, I don't want to say incentivized, but it's required for a certain ideology. I'm just thinking of that in real time. I don't have anything very nuanced about it. But
we can think about it in this way. There's a real sense in which the golden calf of European modernity was nationalism.
Right.
And it's something that convinced people they should live and die for it. Democratic practices themselves come through the nutshell of the nation state that has a monopoly on violence, a monopoly on institutions of public administration. And Zionism is a particular kind of nationalism of a hated and terrorized and traumatized peoples in a Jew-hating Europe. And they're looking for a way out. And they're jumping out of the burning buildings of Jew-hating Europe, but taking with them versions of European ideology tied to nation building and nation states as the only thing that will protect them. And they land on people who are already there. And then they start lying. There's no people here. We're not involved in any expulsions when there's 750,000 there. And Einstein and Judah Magnus and Ahaka Ham and others saying we got to coexist with these Arab brothers and sisters, and Jabotinsky and others saying, no, we got to dominate him and we got to annihilate him. And that's where Netanyahu comes from, of course. His father, one of the assistants of Jabotinsky. And so we lost that battle in that context in terms of trying to provide ways in which any people terrorize and traumatize. And coming out of 50 million dead in World War II, and 6 million Jews and millions of communists and socialists and gays and others, that's a level of human barbarity we don't have a language for. Thank God for Paul Celan. Thank God for other poets trying to make sense of it all. But where are we now? Well, now we got the American Empire. Oh my God.
Right. I want to make sure I people don't misunderstand, because I was just thinking now in my head of Marcus Garvey and the KKK, right? Collaborating in a way that Zionists and Nazis collaborated. But the big difference, of course, is that I want to be very clear, Black separatists did not dominate and colonize and ethnically cleanse another people. So I want to be very clear about the limits to the parallel.
And Garvey, of course, it was strategic. He was meeting with the Klan to let them know he was going to organize in the South. And if they attacked Black people, he was going to attack back. So it was just a matter of saying, look, we here to stay, and we're going to have some agreement, or we're going to have a civil war down here. But he still got in trouble with Du Bois and others, deeply upset when he brought the Klan there. And so definitely. But it's also true, my dear sister, that when Black people went to Liberia, you had another settler colonial situation, just like Australia, Canada, just like the United States, just like Israel. I mean, settler colonial regimes, you know, cut across different colors and regions and continents. You see, you subordinate indigenous peoples, you degrade indigenous peoples, you act as if nothing was there before you arrived, and think that lo and behold, history will not come get you, the chickens won't come home to roost, the sooner you won't reap what you sow. And of course, we're experiencing a chickens come home to roost moment in the American Empire. It's just that we have to fight because of so many precious folk, especially poor and working people of all colors, who will disproportionately suffer. And to see the 1% and to see the billionaires and the multi-billionaires just breakdancing to the White House, breakdancing in Florida, breakdancing to the bank. You know, for those of us who come out of Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X and the Black freedom fighters of the 60s, it boils our blood. We just have to make sure we keep love at the center of it. We can't be obsessed with hating folk. We got to love the people who are being hated and be in solidarity with people who are being hated, whoever they are, wherever they are.
You know, I realized that I know nothing. I'm just going to totally admit it. I've never studied about Liberia. So I don't know anything about it. But what you've just described to me sounds like it's another example of multicultural, maybe militarism, multicultural settler colonialism.
Wonderful. You can imagine just Liberia, Liberty.
Yeah, exactly.
Monroe,
right.
Named after James Monroe. You say, oh, come on now. You know.
Yeah.
How you going to treat the precious indigenous folk in that part of Africa as you reshape it? And again, you know, the Black folk who were gone, they were running from,
of course,
New World barbarity, just like Jews coming to, could have been Uganda, could have been Central America, could have been the Middle East. Our Jewish brothers and sisters and siblings, they were trying to get out some of the most barbaric conditions conceivable. But we have to respect people enough to stay in contact with their humanity, to make them responsible and answerable for their actions. And that's true for their communities. That's true for their nation states. That's true for neocolonial elites in Africa and Asia that are still collaborating with various imperial elites in Paris and London and the United States. And that's true on the block. It's true on the corner. It's true in our neighborhoods. that we all have to take responsibility, but we have to have a moral and a spiritual compass so we're not on anybody's plantation, though, Sister Kitty. And that's always a problem.
You know, it's interesting. You reminded me when you were talking about racism, you remind me of something the great Reverend William Barber said, which it was on Bill Maher, I think. And he said something about how much white liberals love to talk about poor whites' racism and not their own. And I do think that often in terms of the, like you just referred to, the fetishization of racism, I think often people use racism as an excuse to write people off. And what they say is, of course, we can't organize around class because these people are racist. It's like, wait, you have that totally backwards. That's one of the reasons why you have to organize around class, because if you want people to organize around identity and they're being, you know, played by racist rich people, basically a divide and conquer thing, the way you can defeat that, I'm not saying everyone is redeemable and reachable, but of course, the way, right, one of the main ways you defeat that is precisely by saying you're being pitted against each other, you're being played. The thing you should be identifying around is your shared class interest.
Oh, absolutely. And when it comes to just institutional capacity to mobilize around identity, white supremacy will win every time. So you got hundreds of years of backdrop. So all you got to do is just push buttons.
Right.
And secondly, you got ruling classes, because fascism is very much about big business, big military coming together, and then convincing ordinary people that they should be at each other's throats, that they should actually be attempting to demonize the vulnerable rather than organize and confront the most powerful. And so you get that kind of right-wing populism that blurs into authoritarianism, that moves toward a fascism. And we've seen that all around the world. The United States takes a distinctive form because white supremacy sits so much at the center of our project. But I would always stress the moral and the spiritual even as much as the interest. That's why I've never liked the slogan of the Black Congressional Caucus that says we have no permanent friends, no permanent enemies, we only have permanent interests. You see, that's too narrow. That's too Machiavellian. Of course, we have interests, but we also have virtues. We have values. We have visions. We have spirituality. We have morality. You see, so you can convince people that it's not in your interest to be concerned about genocide in Gaza. Be concerned about the price of eggs. That's what you ought to focus on. Well, you see, that's too narrow. That's truncated. Of course you want to be concerned about the price of eggs. We don't have to worry about that. You're going to be concerned about it anyway. We have to deal with inflation and so forth. But if you don't have any moral and spiritual sensibility that leads you to be in solidarity with what's happening in Haiti and Sudan and Congo and Gaza and Lebanon and Muslims in China and the woman life freedom movement in Iran and landless workers in Brazil and so forth. And they say, oh, Brother West, that just sounds too ephemeral. We're concerned about the strategic and tactical dimensions of it. Strategy and tactics, very important. If that's all you have, you're going to end up on somebody's plantation.
Right.
That's why we got too many leftists, for example, that don't want to say a word about the dissenting voices that just been sent to jail in China, in Hong Kong. They don't want to say a word about the Muslims in China or the various ways in which working peoples are still subordinated in China. They don't want to say a word about the mullahs in Iran that's crushing the young sisters because, well, those are talking points of the State Department. I don't give a goddamn about no State Department. I know how decrepit they are. I know how corrupt they are, but I got my own morality. I got my own spirituality, and I'm concerned about oppressed people everywhere, no matter where they are, because that's the kind of person I choose to be in life, which makes you a free person. You're not on anybody's plantation.
And I think on the other side of what we were saying is the way that liberals can use racism as an excuse to write people off, have contempt for them, and not address the concerns that people have that are not related to racism, or their concerns that they have, and because they're not addressed, it makes it that much easier for someone like a Trump to seduce them. Because, like I always say, you know, people loved comparing Bernie and Trump, And yeah, what they had is that Bernie would say, I feel your pain. I think he was real when he said that. I feel your pain and blame the banks and inequality. And Trump would say, I feel your pain. He was like full of it, but he observed it. I don't think he cares, but he's like astute in some ways. And he would say, and blame Muslims and Mexicans. And then you have liberals who just say everything is okay. And that's why I think you have to be reaching out to people's pain. I think one of Harris's major problems was, and Nina Turner said this, she actually said in 2016 about Hillary Clinton, I think it's comparable, which is that Bernie felt your pain, Trump pretended to feel your pain, and no one believed that Hillary felt your pain. And I don't think that anyone thought that Kamala felt people's pain. And that's not even a policy thing. I mean, that's just a messaging thing. I think it is somewhat reflected in policy as well. But I wanted to know what you thought of Bernie's analysis. He, of course, said that no wonder Kamala didn't win, given that Democrats have abandoned the working class. And he's even hinted at supporting the formation of a new party. I don't know if you saw that at all, but he sent out an email. You did, right? And I don't know. You were, of course, a surrogate for him. So I don't know if you've been in touch, but what do you think of his analysis? And have you spoken to him at all about his plans?
Yeah, you know, Brother Bernie is always my brother. We don't talk regularly at all. I didn't talk to him during the election. I gave him a hug at the tribute to Jesse Jackson in Chicago that Brother John Nichols did such a good job orchestrating and emceeing. But the same was true with Sister Jane, his beloved wife. But no, I think Bernie's problem, though, his timing is off. Because he's so for real. He's so genuine. He's got his heart in the right place when it comes to critique of Wall Street greed. He's got his heart in the right place when it comes to working people. But when you continually then turn to the Democratic Party and the Bidens and talk about them being so pro-working class, and you say that year after year after year after year, and as soon as the election's over, you say Democratic Party abandoned the working class. Well, you just said Biden was the most pro-working class in the history of the country, brother.
Right.
You can't have it both ways.
Right.
And same was true with the ceasefire thing. He's done marvelous work in the last few weeks to fight for the arms embargo against the apartheid regime in Israel and so forth. But he wouldn't say a mumbling word for months, as you recall, because
yeah,
Biden and others didn't want him to
right.
say it. He's down the plantation too long.
He's fired now. Everyone wants to hear that because he is such moral, like concise moral clarity,
moral
right?
Authority.
So people were so used to him saying
authority.
Medicare for all, ceasefire now would have been, yeah.
And I believe, you know, people change their minds. That I've talked about Coates as well. Coates is now, you know, he was tied to an apartheid magazine
Coates,
with
yeah.
the Atlantic, with Brother Goldberg,
yep.
who was what, IDF
yep.
private guard in the prison. That's where Coates and some of the black folk come from in Atlantic magazine. They can change their mind. That's beautiful. But being latecomers, people raise certain questions like, wow, it took people a long time to see this reality. Bernie's timing was a little off. He lost credibility. He lost a certain legitimacy in that regard. He could have talked about third party in 2016 when we were talking about. Many of us ran third party. Wouldn't say a mumbling word about us. Not one word the whole time. So that I'm always open because I believe people undergo change and transformation and metamorphosis. But we have to be honest in terms of what people are seeing and what we're seeing with our own eyes. And I think one of the things that's wonderful indeed about your show is that you have what Jane Austen called constancy. A consistency. Nobody's pure. Nobody's free of spot or wrinkle. But to have that constancy and consistency makes a difference, Sister Katie. It really, really does. That's why even when Chomsky, we disagree with Chomsky strategically and tactically about supporting the Biden or Harris, we know the brother's been constant and consistent in his analysis.
Right. Exactly. I agree. And something I really wanted to see happen more is I wanted to see people acknowledge strategic differences without deducing or claiming that that person then was a supporter of genocide. I think there were lots right. of different ways to decide how to vote. What's absolutely indefensible is then after the election, blaming people who vote, who couldn't vote, who couldn't bring themselves to vote because of the genocide, blaming them as opposed to blaming Harris for that, I think is unacceptable. And we're seeing this very racist, vicious, like people fantasizing about, can't wait to see Gaza turned into a parking lot. Can't wait for these people to be deported. And that's absolutely disgusting and misplaced.
Yes, that is disgusting, not excusable.
But speaking of elections, your dear friend and friend of the show, Norman Finkelstein, I told him that you were coming on, and he was at least, you guys have different opinions slightly, though not as different as they seem when it comes to Hamas, October 7th, Nat Turner, the politics of condemnation. But you, I always point to you as someone who's totally consistent, because my big thing with when people are asked to condemn Hamas is that they often do it out of context. They do either, they don't bring up Israel, or if they bring up Israel, they do a false equivalence. And you've always grounded your analysis in the very obvious non-parity between those two sides. And I remember you on Piers Morgan. And by the way, people, I was on Piers Morgan yesterday. And after my interviews, I will play some clips of that. But you called Hamas an anti-terrorist organization. You also acknowledged that they committed crimes against humanity on October 7th. And you asked Piers Morgan, will you condemn the terrorism of Israel? And he refused to do that. And that's such a basic question. I was actually blown away that no one had done that yet. But I asked Norman if he had any questions.
Too. I said, that means you don't believe a Palestinian baby has the same value as an Israeli baby. That makes you a racist.
Yes. And you pushed him and you said, and he was like, I've said it borders on terrorism. You're like, borders on terrorism? You're a free man. This is Piers Morgan Uncensored. Speak. Are you not free to speak? It was a great moment. And we played it once during an interview. But I asked Norman what he would want me to ask you. And he said, I would like to hear his honest, and all caps, not implying that you're not honest. So he's just being very rigorous, honest assessment of what went right and what went wrong in his campaign. And of course, Norman, for people who don't know, Norman Finkelstein endorsed you and did events with you.
Yes, he did. He was there at the club, the Comedy Cellar, and he was there in Harlem in Marcus Garvey Park. And one of the wonderful things about this campaign is to be able to spend this kind of time with him. We marched together October 6th in New York with Sister Deborah as well. But I mean,
Deborah Winger.
I forget her last name because I had met her, but it was a wonderful time.
Oh, no, I wasn't correcting you. I was just for people who don't know who Deborah Winger is, the great actress from Terms of Endearment.
What her last name. But no, the answer to Brother Norman's question would take a while because an honest critique of what we were doing would require a serious step by step. Because, see, when I took off, I'm with the People's Party, you see. And then I moved to the Green Party. And then I have to break and become independent. And so already I've had number of time and resources that went in places that were not able to facilitate what I wanted to do as an independent candidate. And I ran into, you know, the conflict with the People's Party. I ran into conflict with the Green Party. And to go into all those details is something that we certainly will do at some point. But it's hard to do right now. And when we finally got our footing, it was very difficult. And then it looks like right when we're zeroing in on Biden, we get this shift. And being a Black man running with Sister Melina, now I don't want to acknowledge Sister Melina Abdullah. She was magnificent as the vice presidential running mate of mine. We get a shift with Sister Harris. So then all of the Black folk who had begun to lean my way, a portion, not all of them, but a significant portion, then shift. And they go tribal on me. It's, we got to have a Black woman at the highest rate. Then we got Obama all over again. I said, well, you all know what I said about Obama.
Black people in trouble.
High place. Peace Prize with 7 wars, dropping drones on innocent people and destroying Libya with the help of Hillary Clinton. We go on and on and on, right? But that's something that's real. You know, the politics of representation, of bourgeois representation, still cuts very deep in America, whatever group. And that was something that hit us hard. You know, we lost a number of folks, especially folk who have been tied to the coming out of the Black church and coming out of Black communal networks and Black sororities and fraternities and what have you. And I understand it. I do understand it because any blow against white supremacy, I'm going to get excited about. But if it is a touch against white supremacy that says nothing about the plight of the Black masses, Black poor people and Black working people, let alone all Black poor, and I mean all poor and all working people, then I acknowledge that representation is a moment, but it's such a little small moment compared to the gravitas of the suffering that the structures and institutions are bringing to bear on poor and working people. And so you get a Black bourgeois incorporation and co-optation. And now we see, of course, all the money. Again, we talk about everybody being for sale. You're just throwing out money, you know, millions and millions and millions of dollars of Black journalists and Black entertainers and so forth and so on. You say, oh my God, is that the conception of organizing? Is that the conception of trying to generate some grounds of appeal and attraction of a candidate, trotting out the entertainers and trotting out these journalists and making sure they have nice little easy interviews and what have you? You say, oh my God, what about truth?
And truth, of course, that can cover it up. Oh, sorry.
And then try to cover it up. Absolutely.
And they can, I'm not dismissing representation, obviously, but sometimes that can be more deceptive because you kind of lower your guard. You assume that the people in the room are representing you in more ways than just physical representation. And, you know, I think about Kamala Harris's brother-in-law, Tony West, I believe is his name, being a big CEO at Uber. Yeah.
That's right.
And of course, what they tried to do. And I do appreciate how much, because sometimes I find myself, I mean, this is important, but sometimes I feel like I don't embrace the value of helping everyone. Like I have to say, and this disproportionately helps people of color, but the truth is I care about white suffering people too, white
Absolutely.
Poor people too. And that's something you're very good at. But I think I also want to be careful. But, you know, that, of course, not only hurt all working people, but I guess it's a very strategically useful thing for people. I'm wondering, why do I always say, and that disproportionately helps people of color? Not only because it's important, but I also realize that it's an important way to reach people who haven't yet rejected, kind of seen through the weaponization of identity politics. So first, it's like a gateway drug. You say, this disproportionately hurts people of color. Then you can get to the next point, which is like, how about we just don't want anyone to hurt?
Yes. You know? Absolutely. But when you look at it just for a moment through biblical lens, what you do for the least of these,
right?
The 25th chapter of Matthew that comes out of prophetic Judaism, loving thy neighbor as thyself in Leviticus, it means that if you're doing something for the least of these, then you're already more likely inclusive for the others. Because if you're doing it for them, then you're providing an opportunity that is potentially embracing and usually and actually embracing for everybody. Now, and people say, well, no, that's not always the case, because if you zero in on just indigenous peoples or just the women or just the Black folk, then you're leaving out the white folk. Well, no, it's a matter of ensuring that there's fairness, and there's been such unfairness for so long. And that's one reason why I've never really been a DEI kind of person, because I've never been willing to live and die for diversity and inclusion. That ain't what I'm living and dying for. I'm living and dying for truth, justice, and love, and freedom. And that is a conception in which you're trying to embrace everybody. And for so long, it's only been the top slice that's been embraced. So you go for the least of these. And that's, again, why I think the commitment to our precious trans folk. And we can disagree with our precious trans folk on different issues. It's not the question. But you make sure their humanity, their dignity, and their sanctity is affirmed, just like anybody else who has a dignity and a sanctity as a human being, qua human being. And then as a Christian, I just understand it in terms of made in the image and likeness of a loving God.
Right. You know, I wanted to ask you, the great friend of the show, and I know friend of yours, Mark Lamont Hill, recently spoke at the CBC, and he said something. I just want to read a quote. Having liberated your, he's talking obviously about Palestine, having liberated yourself from oppression doesn't give you the right to oppress others. Look at how South Africa responds versus how Germany responds to Israel. And I want to ask you to respond to that quote.
The only thing is that to compare South Africa with Germany is going to be a bit misleading, because you got Germany was the site of the criminality and barbarity, and it was the Nazis as Germans who facilitated and sponsored that, where South Africa is responding to the issue of genocide, but it didn't take place in their land. It didn't take place in their particular habitat. And so the real challenge would be, for example, if you had a Black nation that was engaged in genocide and that had come out of South Africa, would South Africa then have the same energy and the same principle and the same integrity? I think that would be a little closer analogy, but I hear what he's saying, and he's right about that, that in the end, thank God that South Africa stepped forward and is concerned about accenting truth and justice on an international scale, and even now generating the warrants for the arrest.
Right. Thank God for that. Yeah.
Various war criminals.
Mm-hmm. And Marco Montiel also highlighted the solidarity between the Black liberation movement and Palestinian struggle for freedom. And he mentioned the change in heart that many Black revolutionaries had towards Zionism in the 1950s. What are your thoughts on that? And what was your personal journey with Palestine?
Yeah, but I've always been one that's had a deep solidarity and sensitivity to Palestinians, though maybe it's because I met Edward Said so early in my life. I started teaching when I was 23, right across the street from him. And we worked together. We had teach-ins together. I would see Ahmad and in those days, Christopher Hitchin was very much a part of the movement. Alexander Colburn was in his living room a lot of the time. Jonathan Cole, Jewish brother, was there. Of course, Chomsky, we can go on and on. Harry Magdoff and Paul Sweezy. It's a whole network of folk. So I was already in my 20s, and I had already been influenced by the Black Panther Party as a teenager. I couldn't join because I'm a Jesus-loving free Black man, but I worked very closely with them. And so for me, it was always a both and. I mean, if Jewish brothers and sisters are catching hell, I'm in solidarity with them. If Palestinian brothers and sisters are catching hell, I'm in solidarity with them. If Black folk are, if white folk are, it was always just a matter of just moral consistency in that regard. And it does take a certain risk because you get misunderstood. And I tell Black folk all the time, if there was a Black supremacist regime that was degrading and exploiting white folk, then I'm in solidarity with white folk. I might not go to all of their dances, and they may not be able to produce a Luther Vandross and Aretha Franklin, but hey, morally and spiritually, I'm with them. But that's not the way the modern world has unfolded. It's been disproportionately Black and brown and indigenous people that's had to deal with the forms of brutality and barbarity in the shaping of modern capitalist world. And the socialist attempts to provide alternatives, many of them failing, you know, in the Soviet Union and other places. But it's just a matter of just trying to be honest with yourself, going back to that word, Brother Norman, you see. Definitely.
And I actually want to show you, I think, what happens when that Black internationalist solidaristic tradition is, let's say, violated. Here is someone posted this, and it is from 2014, but I still think it's relevant. Here is a clip of speaker, trigger warning, everyone, Hakeem Jeffries. This is making the rounds recently.
I like how you stay up on all of these. I mean, Anahita and I, we watch your show all the time just to find
thank
what's
you.
Going on in other places.
Oh. And thank you so much, Anahita, for all that you do.
And then you had to deal with the first intifada, and Israel prevailed. And Israel had to deal with the second intifada, and Israel prevailed. And then missiles were flying in December of 2008, and Israel prevailed. And then missiles were flying in November of 2012, and Israel prevailed. And so I'm confident that when it's all said and done, we're going to stand together. Israel today, Israel tomorrow, Israel forever. God bless you.
It was an interesting statement, I thought.
I've never seen that before, but I'm not surprised, though. You know, it's just shame on my dear brother. You know, shame on anybody who would put a flag over truth and justice. If truth and justice is nothing but subordinate moments under any flag, then you end up being a rationalizer and a justifier of forms of oppression, exploitation. In this case, we're talking about genocide and ethnic cleansing and apartheid-like conditions, especially in West Bank and so forth. So that shame on him. But I mean, you know, and I know that, you know, he might deeply believe it, but he's sure getting big money from my APEC. He might deeply believe it, but he needs to say that in order to keep his position.
Right.
And Upton Sinclair used to say, it's hard to get a man to tell the truth if that truth will undermine the possibility of him losing his job.
Right. And who knows, right? As you said, I don't even know which is worse, believing it truly or saying it for the money. And of course, he ran against, he challenged Barbara Lee, who would have made a much better Speaker of the House. Although I would have appreciated her endorsing Bernie over Kamala Harris, but that's another story. That was kind of disappointing. And of course, this Chuck Modi, who posted this tweet, referred to how it echoes George Wallace's 1963 inaugural address, where, of course, he says segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever, which is basically what Hakeem Jeffries is saying about Israel. And I actually know someone who used to work for him, and this was early on in his career, and we went to a fundraising party for him, and we didn't really know his politics. Then I was horrified to see him call Bernie Sanders, I think this was 2016, a gun-toting socialist, as if, you know, socialist is a dirty word. And my mom sent him an email, you know, because she donated something. And then she, you know, they asked her for more money and she explained she'd never like give him another cent because of his McCarthyite smearing of Bernard. And I just want to show you one more clip, if that's okay, because as someone who's so consistent and good at calling out inconsistency. But I guess the final thing is on that clip is, what's it like when you see people who, someone like Hakeem Jeffries, siding with Israel, someone who, you know, claims to care about and be a kind of response to racism and be a sign of the fight against racism?
Well, I mean, it's just sad to see another example of a member of the professional managerial class that is so conformist and that is so complacent and indifferent to the suffering of in this case, hated, terrorized, traumatized people, Palestinians dealing with genocide, but also it's cowardly, you see. And the sad thing is that, see, he and I come from the chocolate side of town, and he would not be in that position if those who created the conditions for him to succeed were as cowardly as he is now. He wouldn't be there. And that's true for Obama, that's true for Harris, and so forth and so on. And so if all you're going to do is ascend to high places and rationalize war crimes, then Harriet Tubman say, dang, maybe I should have left some of those folk down. No, she's going to bring in as many as she can. Maybe I should have picked out and said, I'm going to go through all of this. And they're going to go to those high places and be cowardly. My God, my God. And I always keep that intergenerational connection in mind because, I mean, the idea of having a Black head of the Democratic Party in the House, you know, when I was 25 years old was inconceivable. People were living and dying for that. And they sacrifice, and this is what they end up with? Please. That's what's sad, you see.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wanted to show you, speaking of sad, here's a clip of Matthew Miller of the State Department.
Secretary,
let's take a look at what he used to say.
I think last year it was where he was talking about the warrant for Vladimir Putin said, this was in Senate, said any country that's party to the court has obligations and should fulfill those obligations. So should countries... obligations to international treaties be sort of selective in this way?
No, every country has to make their decision. Every country has to make that decision for themselves. But I don't think there is any equivalence between the case that the ICC has brought against Russia and the case that it has brought against Israel. When you look at the difference between the two countries, Russia is not a democracy, does not have a functioning independent legal system, is not investigating violations of international humanitarian law by its soldiers. Israel is the opposite in all of those cases, a democracy with an independent court system that has hundreds of open cases into allegations against its soldiers. It is important that those processes be allowed to proceed. That is the principle of complementarity under which the ICC was founded. Now, when it comes to countries making the decision, they all have to make their own decisions in the same way that the United States has.
So that's one huge similarity between both Israel and Russia is that neither are members of the ICC, also, just like you.
Yeah, also correct. Also correct.
Okay, right. Well, if they don't have jurisdiction over Israel, why should they have jurisdiction over
Ukraine?
Ukraine
is not a member. Ukraine is a sovereign state, however, that has granted its jurisdiction to another country. I think it might have been Poland, another country, and allowed that country to intervene for them, which is something that sovereign states can do. There is no sovereign state of Palestine. We want to establish a Palestinian state, but that is the fundamental nature of our jurisdictional disagreement with the court on this matter.
So there you go.
Well, you see how he's like a pretzel. He just all twisted up and down and around. The hypocrisy is oozing out his sentences. It's really something to behold. It really is. I mean, see, I think when you really talk about war criminals, that it extends to Biden, it extends to Harris, it extends to Austin, it extends to Thomas Greenfield, it extends to Blinken. I mean, all of these folk have been not just complicitous, they have been full-throated sponsors of genocide. And when Biden said, for example, that the leaders in Iran were sponsoring war crimes because of their supports for their various proxies in the Middle East, that the same exact logic holds. The same exact logic holds. And you're absolutely right. I do believe that the counter-terrorist efforts of oppressed peoples, when Kennedy said, if you make nonviolence impossible, you make violence inevitable in people's resistance. And I'm not one to justify ever killing innocent people. I don't care who it is. And no matter how unpopular I am, I don't believe in killing innocent people. Me and Norman debated this with Du Bois. Boyce has a moment in his biography of John Brown where he's wrestling with John Brown killing some of the innocent children. And Du Bois knows, ooh, he's got a challenge there. He's got to wrestle with it. And Brother Norman and I had a wonderful intellectual wrestling match in that regard. He went with Du Bois. Du Bois in the end justifies it. I don't justify it, but John Brown is still a towering figure for me. I just don't agree with killing innocent children, no matter what the situation is. Doesn't make me pure or anything. That's just who I am. That's the way I choose. Frederick Douglass had to wrestle with that same moment as well in terms of Denmark Vesey and others. All of these are crucial, crucial issues. But in the end, the resistance and the resilience of oppressed peoples, from the music to the organized resistance, is something that that one has to have some critical, yet in the end, it seems to me, some understanding of. So you don't justify crimes, but you understand when people have their backs against the wall in open concentration camps, sooner or later, human beings will respond with a counter-violence, with a counter-terrorism, given the fact that they've been terrorized for so long. And you see that in the U.S. revolution, you see that with indigenous peoples against the U.S. revolutionaries and so forth and so on. But no, it's something to see this brother get all twisted up like that. It's like, Lord have mercy. But even in the case of Russia, you know, I was just reading Lukash's great essay on Gorky. Gorky is one of the greatest artists, close friend of Chekhov, who's my favorite, as you know. But that you can talk about the criminality of Putin and still talk about the expansion of NATO pushing him in a certain direction,
right.
A violation of an agreement that the American Empire made with the Russian Empire and so on. You could be in solidarity with the dissenting voices in Russia that Putin suppresses and still recognize that NATO is an extension of US imperial power. How do you tell those truths in such a way that people don't think that somehow you just an agent of Putin, or people don't think you somehow you just an extension of the State Department. Well, you don't care. I'm not on Putin's plantation. I'm not on State Department's plantation. I'm concerned about truth. I'm concerned about justice. And I'm concerned about making sure that people suffering, be they in the Ukraine, be they in Gaza, be they in Harlem, be they in poor white Appalachia, be they in Brazil, be they in Haiti, we've got to have a solidarity and sensitivity and do all we can to raise our voices. And it's going to be important, you know, these next few years. It's going to test our souls, my dear sister, because you're going to see a whole lot of people give up. You're going to see more and more people sell out. You're going to see more and more people completely cave in. But we have got to be vigilant. Anti-fascist, united fronts, ways in which we sustain our organizations, and ways in which we always keep our joy. And you know, as an artist, don't let nobody steal your joy, ever.
Wanted to ask you if we can watch one more clip, speaking of joy, because people in the comments have been praising you and also asking to show the my Alan Dershowitz interaction today. So do you mind if we watch that?
Absolutely. I love to see it.
So this is me on Piers Morgan with Matt Kennard. So Matt Kennard and I are on the same size. Matt is great. And then on the same side. And then we are debating Alan Dershowitz and John Conricus. And John Conricus is a former IDF soldier and spokesperson. So let's take a look.
That the claim that any criticism, any and all criticism of Israel is anti-Semitic is a total obvious weaponization of anti-Semitism. It's pathetic. It's dangerous. It
nobody
harms
ever
Jews
says
like
that.
Me.
Nobody ever says that, Alan.
You always interrupt people because you're a bully. Please be quiet.
Never.
Is Theodore Meron an anti-Semite? The Holocaust survivor who was on the committee advising the arrest warrants, is he an anti-Semite? Who used to be an ambassador for Israel. The other thing is that, of course, you don't want to hear that Israel's committing war crimes. And you bring up the fact that under the ICC arrest warrants, by that logic, the U.S. could be tried for committing war crimes. Well, guess what? They should be. Because, of course, they committed war crimes. Of course, they committed war crimes in
Iraq. That's the point.
You brought it up yourself.
This is an attack against America.
As if that's disqualifying. But also, Alan's numbers about civilians are totally made up. There's no evidence of this. 90% of the victims of Israel's crimes against humanity have been women and children. And Jonathan, you are shaking your head, but you should be upset. I would be upset if I were you, because you've been implicated in war crimes yourself. You lied about Al-Shifa Hospital. You claimed it was a Hamas stronghold. You were debunked by the BBC, Fox News, and the Washington Post, all of which said you did not provide the evidence.
Not only do I claim it, I stand by it, and there's ample proof of it. And the difference between you and I is that I was on the ground.
Can you let me finish, please? I know you guys are bullies for you.
Okay, Jonathan, I'll let you respond after she's finished.
So you've been implicated in two war crimes. One is you defended Yoav Gallant's starvation order on October 9th when you went on the Twitter Live and you defended it and you called them beasts. You called Palestinians beasts. The other thing is you lied about Al-Shifa Hospital. And what happened then? First of all, you lied. But second of all, I'm going to be charitable and say you didn't lie. Let's say everything you found, even though we know you edited the video and we know this because the BBC, Fox News, and Washington Post all said that. But even if the things that you had found had been there, it would have been a war crime. Why? Because in order to justify the exception to violating a hospital, you have to prove that it's an active terrorist center, which you didn't prove, even with the fake evidence you provided. The other thing is you have to use proportionality no matter what, or else it's a war crime. You absolutely did not use proportionality when you killed hundreds of thousands of people. You executed them. You turned off
hundreds of thousands, did we?
Don't talk over each other. Here's what I'll do. Katie, hold fire. Jonathan, please stop all talking over each other.
You did. You probably know more than I do.
Katie.
And there it is. I did not have my computer literally crashed while I was doing it. So I had to rejoin on a phone, which is why I sound terrible and the camera looks so bad. But anyway,
you don't sound terrible at all.
Oh,
you were on fire, my dear sister, concerned about the suffering of precious human beings. In this case, our precious Palestinian brothers and sisters. Never, ever have to apologize for that. And you know, people, they get caught. You know, they're so used to saying anything with no accountability, answerability, or responsibility. They get caught. And you just lay it out. And you speak from your mind, sharp, your heart, golden, and your soul, rich. And it's a beautiful thing to behold. I can tell you that.
Thank you. Well, thank you. And you are my favorite Pierce Morgan guest. So that means a lot coming from you.
You were courageous there. I'm telling you. Absolutely. Absolutely. But thank you so much for this
time. Thank you for coming on. Of course.
It's always a blessing to be in conversation with you. And just stay strong now. We're in for some dim and dim days, but we'll never allow catastrophe to have the last word. Never, ever.
Yep. And any final words about how people should be fighting against what we're confronting now?
Well, it's just remember that there's people around the world who are on intimate terms with what we're wrestling with all the time, every day of their lives, every generation after generation. And the best of them always hold out with a compassion, with a perseverance, with a solidarity with others, with a willingness to serve and sacrifice for others. And as I said before, keep that joy. Don't be discouraged. Be encouraged, of great courage, and keep your style and keep the smile on your face, even given the dimness of the historical moment.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. West. Always a pleasure to hear from you.
Indeed, indeed. All right. Salute you now. Salute you, my dear sister.
Have a great night.
Have a good one now.
Okay. That was great. Love talking to Dr. West. And do not go anywhere, because we have another amazing guest coming onto the show. And we always love his articles. He's always speaking really inconvenient truths, taking on the powerful. And I'm speaking about none other than Lev Galinkin, who is a Ukrainian-American journalist. He's also the author of A Backpack, A Bear, and 8 Crates of Vodka. So welcome, Lev. Hi, Lev. How are you?
I'm better now that I'm not muted, so I'm doing better.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm glad that you are muted, I'm sure, by a lot of people who try to cancel you, but not on this show.
Yeah.
So you have a recent article about Tulsi Gabbard. It was in Newsweek. Washington's craven warmongers outrageously smear Tulsi Gabbard for telling the truth. So tell us about who these warmongers are. And we actually have some of the, so when you mention them, we have some of the tweets ready to show. But tell us about who some of these warmongers are and what truth she was telling.
The question isn't even about the truth she was telling. The question is that she's being accused of being a Russian spy. She's being accused of treason to the United States. It doesn't matter what she was. She could be raving, running down Fifth Avenue raving. That still doesn't excuse to these people. And these people, remember, Katie, these are the people who say we are adults. We care about disinformation. We care about national security. We don't lie about things. That's Trump does that. We actually are important people who are adults. And here we have Elizabeth Warren, who blankly just accuses Gabbard of being in Putin's pocket. Debbie Wasserman Schultz, another member of Congress. These are people who are supposed to be the adults. Then we have the usual warmongering David Frum, people from the Never Trump MAGA, and Tom Nichols, who, while Gabbard spent 2 decades in the military, Tom Nichols preferred to teach in the war college. So, being in the atmosphere, you know, he fought not so much in the battlefield, but in the marketplace of ideas.
Right.
Almost all of these people have not served a day in their life, and they are accusing a lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army of treason with no evidence and no repercussions, none. They're just able to say that.
Right, misinformation, fake news. So here's David Frum, one of the architects of the Iraq War. Why not cut out the middlewoman and just name Putin as director of moral intelligence? Here's Tom Nichols. Tulsi Gabbard's nomination is a national security risk. Then we have Rep. Abigail Spangberger. The men and women of the U.S. intelligence community honor their oaths by collecting the vital intelligence that keeps our fellow Americans safe. The global threats we face require a director of national intelligence who would do the same. Tulsi Gabbard is not that person. And this, of course, I forgot to mention, this is because Trump has named her as director of national intelligence. Mm-hmm. The objections to her nomination transcend partisan politics. This is a matter of national security. Someone who has aligned herself with Vladimir Putin and Bashar al-Assad and trafficked in Russian-backed conspiracy theories, ironic because these are conspiracy theories, is an unsuitable and potentially dangerous selection. Now, let's take a look, since Abigail Spangberger is such a truth teller. Let's take a look at Abigail telling a truth about, speaking of foreign policy, telling an interesting truth about Russia.
He's the president of the United States, and there are soldiers and Marines overseas who are risking their lives and potentially have a bounty on their head put there by the Russian government. And the fact that he didn't take the time to read the document is not an excuse for the fact that what comes next. That's my question. What comes next?
A bounty on their head. Now, Lev, as someone who is Ukrainian-American and follows Russian-Ukrainian politics closely and writes about it, what can you tell us about this bounty?
Well, I don't even need to tell you anything as you need to speak Russian or Ukrainian or Pashto or anything, because Biden's own administration. To go back for a minute, this was the central attack on Donald Trump in the 2020 election about foreign policy. Russians are putting bounties on the heads of American soldiers in Afghanistan. So this was not just a little rumor. This, I'm pretty sure they mentioned it in the debates against Trump. This was repeated over and over. He's letting our soldiers die, okay? And this was echoed everywhere. Russians are putting bounties. And you see how she was on CNN talking about how this is the worst thing ever, okay? After Biden became president, his own administration quietly admitted there is pretty much little to no basis for this, okay? So again, you don't have to listen to Lev Golinkin. You don't have to speak any foreign languages. It's the Biden's own administration admitted there's little to no evidence for this. And here we have this congresswoman. To this day, she has a tweet about it, still up, proudly up. This is somebody who's concerned about disinformation. Where is a video of her apologizing for spreading this rumor? Where's that kind of, if she cares so much about national security, and why? You see that the hypocrisy that comes out of here is just insane. And I think that's part of the wave that's behind Trump's success. It's just, having somebody like David Frum talk about anything, I mean, it's like having the guy who designed the Hindenburg, you know, give lectures on fire safety. Like, right. Why is this person even talking? You know, and not only is he talking, he's right, he's talking in major media. And he is just accusing this, you know, David Frum helped lay us into a war. Tulsi Gabbard was in a combat medic unit patching up the American soldiers who were mangled from that war. And how do you even have just the basic human ability to just go up there and then accuse her of treason, accuse her of being in the pockets of others? Like, it's just... it's hard. You just have to reflect on, like, what kind of a person would even have the gall to do this? And moreover, what kind of a media outlet would put him on?
Right. And what is it that they dislike about her? I mean, they accuse her of meeting with Assad, but as you pointed out, so did Nancy Pelosi. So what do you think it is?
They accuse her of meeting with Assad. You could have a gigantic coffee table book, as I wrote in my article, of United States leaders meeting with the worst dictators imaginable. Okay. She is in many ways anti-war. And that is all of these people belong into this foreign policy apparatus. And this is a machinery of lobbyism, of think tanks, of rotating jobs in these positions, of board members of board members of Raytheon and other companies, and of the media who love wars. These people are part of this giant foreign policy war apparatus. And the number one thing for this apparatus is to survive. is to continue going. Anything that poses a challenge to it is a problem. Tulsi Gabbard is a lieutenant colonel with 20-plus years experience in the U.S. Army who eloquently says, you know what, war is a horrible thing and we should not be doing it unless we really, really have to, and a lot of times we don't. She poses an existential threat to them. People start listening to her, and suddenly they start asking, why is David Frum saying anything? Why is anybody listening to him? They start asking, you know, they start asking these things. So this is why they hate her for that. And it's the same thing, the biggest warmonger of them all, Hillary Clinton. Well, I should, it's really hard to pick who's the biggest of them all, but she's definitely in the, you know, yeah, she's in the pantheon. She basically baselessly accused Tulsi. She insinuated she was, you know, a Russian asset. And again, this is somebody who's just, the reason she did it is because Clinton is just psychologically incapable of owning anything else, okay? Hillary Clinton cannot fail. She can only be failed by the world. And so she made up this lie. She went with it. The media just didn't challenge her on this, didn't ask for anything. And again, I just want to point out that, like, look at the back, like, in the 1950s, we had the Red Scare. We had Joseph McCarthy, okay? Now, as Glenn Greenwald pointed out, at least McCarthy had the decency to wave, like, papers to pretend he had information on people. These people don't even do that. But McCarthy went left and right accusing and people, and entire careers and lives were destroyed because of that. Right. And then finally, in around 1954, so 70 years ago, the U.S., McCarthy finally took on the U.S. Army, and the Army got sick of him. Right. And the Army just eviscerated him. There's a famous, you know, have you no decency type quote. And then McCarthy slunk away and spent the rest of the short remaining time of his life as an alcoholic hated by everyone. And from that on, yes, richly deserved. From that point on, until about 2016, the notion that you could accuse somebody of treason, of serving a foreign power, as I said in the Newsweek piece, this is the only crime that's explicitly outlined in our Constitution, treason. People didn't do that. It was beyond the pale because they realized that, you know, just the danger of it, okay? And then suddenly we have everybody in the resistance starts accusing people of being Russian. You know, my mentor, Steve Cohen, was accused of being a Russian stooge. Max Boot, whose wife literally was indicted for being a foreign agent. Okay.
I didn't know that. For which country?
South Korea.
Oh, my God. I had no idea. Wow. Okay.
Oh, yeah. And she wrote pieces in the Washington Post with him. She wrote at least one piece. She was arrested, like, for being a foreign agent. So Max Boot was, you know, the whole time the foreign agent was in the house with him.
Oh, my gosh. Wow. Has he been called out for that?
Oh, yeah. But, again, that would mean that these people or the people who employ them would have to have a shred of decency, which they don't.
Right.
These people make McCarthy look like the decent one.
I just want to say for myself, like, there are things that I don't like about Tulsi Gabbard, but that's not really relevant to this discussion.
It doesn't matter what she was for.
Right.
The point is, you accuse somebody of treason, have the evidence. It doesn't matter if you're accusing Hannibal Lecter of treason.
Right.
Like, that is not something you just blatantly do. And if Tulsi Gabbard was not a public figure, which in the U.S., our libel laws, it's very hard to win a libel case because of the First Amendment, which I actually think is a good thing. But if you're a public figure like Tulsi Gabbard is, you can be accused of anything. And you can, the odds of you being able to win that case are infinitely small.
Right.
So, I mean, and Tulsi even brought up a case against Clinton for her lie about her being a foreign agent. But after a while, she had to drop it because, like I said, it's you cannot win a case as a public figure. The standard for that is so incredibly high.
Right.
You're talking Elizabeth Warren. You're talking, you know, again, this is somebody who dresses up and says, you know, I'm the responsible person. Right. I'm the person.
Right. We don't lie. Yeah. Yeah, that was really, I couldn't believe that. Yeah.
without a shred of evidence, you know, and even Alexander Vindman, who himself, this is somebody who was attacked by Republicans when he spoke out against Trump. And he was attacked by having, you know, they're saying he might have dual loyalties because he, like me, is originally from Ukraine.
Right.
And I defended him at that time, again, based not on anything that he said.
Your principles, but,
But what?
Because you're principled.
Yeah. Because it's, you shouldn't be doing this, you know?
Right. Yeah.
And he then turned around and accused somebody of just, again, of being a Russian asset on his end. And it's like, you know, like, you think you were on the receiving end of this. You think you'd have, you know, you'd have it. And this is why she brings out the worst in the people who are part of this war, you know, call it the blob, call it the military industrial complex, like Eisenhower. She brings out the worst. And it's incredible that these, anybody who says that, the media should stop immediately and say, what is your evidence?
Right. Yeah, but of course they won't.
But so the burden is not just on these McCarthyites. The burden is on those who don't challenge them.
Right. And I want to ask you, speaking of foreign policy and Russia, Ukraine. So obviously, Biden recently approved the use of U.S. missiles to strike into Russia, and these contentious and in many countries illegal landmines for use by Ukraine. What are your thoughts on that?
Ukraine has, even before these, was the most landmined, the Donbass region of eastern Ukraine was the most landmined region in the world, with both the Russian forces and the Ukrainian forces setting up landmines without even marking, and then nobody knows where they are. The amount of kids that have been destroyed by this is, it will take decades to demine that area. It's one of those things that just doesn't get reported, but it's like the most mined area in the world is in Eastern Europe. Okay. In these, and again, nobody involved cares about the actual people of Eastern Ukraine. So it gets reported very little. So the Biden doing this is, I mean, is it any different from allowing Ukraine to use cluster munitions? Is it any, you know, it's the thing that I think is very important to remember here is that, you know, this is an escalation, in, not so much landmines, but the allowing Ukraine to strike targets in Russia, which, you know, people talk about nuclear weapons. And I think people have this wrong idea that, like, you know, Russia would never use a tactical nuclear weapon on Ukraine because it's next door. You know, why it would be suicide. And what people don't understand is that, you know, a tactical nuclear weapon, it's used and it's considered, you can then have troops enter the area very shortly afterwards. Okay. In the matter of a couple of weeks, it'll be, you know, obviously depending on the weapon used, but in a matter of a couple of weeks, it'll be considered safe enough to enter. So the people who think that Russia is never going to use this because they're afraid of it blowing back at them just don't understand that these weapons are specifically designed to be used in a certain area and then to be occupied. So I think that makes it so much more dangerous because people just don't understand it. Just think like Russia would never do that. So that's, you know, that is a very, very dangerous thing that is just amping up quickly. And the other, I mean, right now in Ukraine, it's nobody knows what the Trump administration is going to do. And I think anybody who says they do know is lying, because you have people. He has chosen people ranging from we have no business being in Ukraine, we need to push them to settle, ranging to from that to we're going to flood Ukraine with weapons even more. It's really, which of them is he going to listen to?
Right.
Well, so it's really unknown.
And in case we want to know what this was about, let's play a clip. Sometimes it's really refreshing when people are honest about their true motives. Now, someone who is a big fan of the proxy war in Ukraine, which, of course, they don't call it that. They just call it, a war to save Taiwan, as he likes to say. He always links it back to Taiwan. is, not surprisingly, everyone should be able to predict this, none other than Lindsey Graham. So we're going to play him here. He makes some interesting revelations about what the war in Ukraine is really about.
Ukraine is still standing. This war is about money. People don't talk much about it. But you know the richest country in all of Europe for rare earth minerals is Ukraine. $2 to $7 trillion worth of minerals that are rare earth minerals, very relevant to the 21st century. Ukraine's ready to do a deal with us, not the Russians. So it's in our interest to make sure that Russia doesn't take over the place. It's the breadbasket of really the developing world. 50% of all the food going to Africa comes out of Ukraine. We can make money and have an economic relationship with Ukraine that'd be very beneficial to us with peace. So Donald Trump's going to do a deal to get our money back, to enrich ourselves with rare earth minerals, a good deal for Ukraine and us. And he's going to bring peace. And Biden's been a disaster when it comes to containing bad guys.
So, Lev, how do you feel about this as someone who is from Ukraine?
I appreciate his candor very, very, very much. You know, he's saying the quiet part loud. I think here's the interesting thing. I write a lot about, you know, the far right in Ukraine, the neo-Nazis, the neo-fascists, and There's one thing that they have absolutely 100% right.
Thanks again for listening to The Katie Helper Show. To hear the rest of that discussion, please join the Patreon at patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. Our show is produced by me, Katie Helper. Brad Bloom is our audio engineer and an associate producer on the show. Our researcher is Joshua Bregman. And our theme song is by the band Cordova. See you next time.